It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I tried ski touring one day at Kincaid Park, and it blew my mind. A dog pulled me on skis faster than I believed possible, and I immediately picked up on the intelligence and athleticism of the animal. The feel is much like dog mushing, but much easier to get into because you don't need an entire team. Your own pet may be able to do it, if you both learn how. In the first half of today's show, we'll talk about ski touring, how it is done, and what it takes to start. In the second half, we'll stay on the subject of dogs in winter, with information the rest of us need about keeping pets healthy in the cold, and tips for taking your dog on winter outdoor activities. Dog lovers should definitely stay tuned for today's show. Well, for the first half of our show today, we're talking about ski touring, and I have a couple of ski touring enthusiasts who are active in the Anchorage Ski Tour Club. What is ski touring? Well, you may have seen it if you've seen a cross-country skier around Anchorage being actually pulled by a dog, not walking your dog, but actually the dog is providing the power that makes you go. And in the studio today to tell us about this, how you could get into it and what it's like and why you'd want to do it, Chuck Pratt, who sets up races and has been involved with the Anchorage Ski Tour Club for quite a while. Thanks for being here, Chuck.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
And Kim Wells, who is also with the club, has been with the club for many years. She's also a musher, and she also works with beginners to help them learn how to go skiing with their dogs and be pulled along. And Kim, let's start with you. Like, why would someone want to do this? What's the pleasure? What's the attraction of ski touring for you?
Well, there are quite a few things, but some of the first things that come to mind is if you have your dog and you enjoy being with your dog, it's a great way to do that. You know, in the city we do have leash laws, and it's a way to keep your dog close to you. They're safe, gets you off the couch in the winter when it's those long dark months. It's exercise, spending time with your dog, not just leaving them home and you having to motivate yourself to get up off the couch and go out and do something physical. So spending the time with the dog, if you have a little bit of a need for speed in some cases, there's that.
It does go fast. I tried this once and I was amazed at how fast
they are. Powerful. If I'm even close to correct, a dog can weight pull up to 9 times their own weight. So if you whack some skis, you've reduced the glide, or you've improved the glide, so the dog isn't having to pull and you're skiing along and helping them. The forward locomotion with you and the dog, you're going to fly, depending on the dog size, but not everybody wants the speed, so.
Maybe not with my little Westie, but yeah.
Maybe not.
Chuck, seems like the teamwork is a big aspect of this, of sort of like working with your dog and having this relationship with the dog of accomplishing something.
Oh, definitely. It is. It's really easy to try to think you can just stand there and get pulled by the dog, but you're not going to go very far, or he's not going to have a good time, you know? So it's definitely a joint effort, not only in commands and consistency, but also in physical exercise, you know, propelling yourself up the hill, down the trail. You have to be nice to your friend, you know?
Yeah. And we're not just talking about having a leash or something, right? We're talking about having a proper harness and having a little bit of training and doing something that's going to be, there's more to this than meets the eye, right?
Oh, quite a bit, Kim? Actually. As I mentioned earlier, Chuck and I also, do these clinics, and we really do cover all those topics about gear, among other things, and we can talk about that.
Yeah,
more
describe
later.
What does that harness consist of?
Actually, it's a pretty affordable sport because the harness, there's a dog harness, and there's a couple different styles, and we won't go into the details, but we at the clinic we do show the different styles, their pros and cons, but we use the musher style, the X-back harness, so that the dog is
distributes the pressure.
It's distributing the pressure so that the dog isn't, injured in any way. The harness needs to fit properly. We do go over that with people in the clinics. So that's it for the harness part. And then we wear a special belt. Also, climbing harnesses work pretty well, but we cover that kind of stuff too. And then we have a very important line between the dog and us called our tug line, and it's got bungee in it. So it protects both us and the dog from jerking. So other than your typical ski boots, poles, and skis.
Which is like the racing skis you see anybody using out at Kincaid.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't want metal-edged, but we do encourage skate skiing. People can classical ski with their dogs as well. And, there's all kinds of little tidbits we can talk about the pros and cons of those. But really, the setup of the dog's harness, the bungee line, and the human's belt are about it. That's pretty, it's pretty simple.
Plus a dog.
Well, the dog being the key factor, of course.
I would think that a good, strong dog that really likes being outdoors and really running would be an important part of this.
Any dog is a good dog as long as he has a good head. He, she, you know.
In other words, trainable.
Trainable, right, that you're working together. Uh-huh. I've skied behind a Jack Russell Terrier.
Wow.
And I've also, we have a member of our club who has a Mastiff.
Wow.
And that guy has worked with his dog really hard and over the years has come along. So it's a big dog. There's lots of power. Doesn't go fast, but it's come a long ways. So any dog has the capacity, as long as it has the head and the desire to pull, and then you're consistent with teaching the commands and, you know, knowing what to expect. So there are certain dogs that make, you know, better pullers, like huskies.
Presumably the dogs that were bred for mushing, right?
The mushing dogs. But the last few years, they've started breeding in German shorthead pointers because they're all lungs on legs. And they have slightly thinner coats. So they're breeding thinner coats that don't overheat. So a lot of the sprint mushers will be running German shorthaired pointer husky mixes. There are some people that are breeding in greyhounds for even more speed and short burst endurance.
Mm.
So it all depends upon what you're looking to do. A nice Mackenzie River husky or the Malamutes, those dogs will pull you for a long way at a slow pace. So if you're a big guy, I'd get a bigger dog that can just, tripes along.
I think one of the sort of obvious questions here, which is occurring to me, is like, what percentage of the effort that's going into this is from the skier and what percentage is from the dog? Because doesn't sound like you're just sitting there the whole time, right? You're not just...
Well, we definitely discourage that because it is a team sport. It is about the dog pulling and enjoying it and you skiing and participating and getting your exercise too.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, really is a team thing in every way. I don't ever want anybody to think that you're just being water skiing, dog pulling you, and that's all it's about. Like Chuck said earlier, if you do that, your dog's going to wear out a lot quicker. If they're doing all the work and you're just going along for the ride, that's not fair. And it's not as fun.
Uh-huh.
You need to be out there, breathing that fresh air and going, going down
exercise,
the trail,
yeah.
and doing your thing too. So, but when you say what percentage,
hard to tell.
It's hard to tell. It varies because if you've got the little dog, he's out there strutting himself down the trail and he's enjoying himself. You're going to work a little harder than I might with my 55, 60 pound husky pointer mix or my mm-hmm. Alaskan husky. So it depends on the dog and your skiing ability. The trail conditions.
The terrain offers a lot,
yeah.
Based upon...
Dog's not going to be able to pull you up a steep hill.
When you start going up
up
the grade, then you're going to have to, work harder. And then when you're actually going downhill, then you actually want to slow down because you don't want to run over the dog.
Right.
There's one dog in particular, this dog Atla, who's legendary. He was like, we've heard of the hand of God. Going up a hill, he just would charge, and you don't really have to work going up the hill.
That sounds nice.
Well, he was named after our famous
George Atla. Yeah,
George Atla, right,
I grew up watching him on TV.
Yes.
Mushing when we used to have mushing on TV in Anchorage.
Right.
I'm dreaming now, like thinking, oh my gosh, I don't have to, like, be at the top of the hill and be panting. I can get some help. That sounds nice.
Well, it depends on the dog.
Yeah, and, that's right.
And depends upon what you want. If you're in a race or mm-hmm. What you're trying to do for that.
So Chuck, tell me about your dogs. What kind of dogs do you have?
I have German short-haired pointer mixes from Egil Ellis lines.
So it was you got your dogs for ski touring.
I had an Australian Shepherd that I telemark skied with and taught to ski behind me. And he passed away, and I knew I wanted to get into ski-during. So at some point, family came along with trying to get another dog, and I went to a musher, and I lucked out. If I hadn't had my dog Shadow and had such a great head for the sport and be a great leader, I wouldn't be sitting here right now and so enthusiastic about mm-hmm. it. And over the time, I wanted a little more power, and then also with the family, to be able to go out and do it just instead of one person ski-during and everybody else skiing. So we ended up getting three dogs eventually, and that's pretty fun.
So you typically just ski with one at a time, though, right?
No.
You do it with a team?
I do it one, two, and all three dogs.
Wow.
Yeah, all three dogs. And then...
That must be the, sort of the advanced sport, because I would think you'd have so much power and speed.
Yeah, you want your dogs to kind of listen to you a little bit if you're going to run three.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dogs are pretty well-behaved. They do pretty well. Uh-huh. But then they're 50-pound females, so it's not overpower. Kim has... more rambunctious yeah. boys, and I've with two of her boys, I've felt more power and drive than with my three gals. But I can control them going down the trail.
You know? Tell me about your dogs, Kim.
Well, I actually currently have 10.
10 dogs.
Yeah, because I do mush and ski jor, which is why. Because you don't need 10 dogs to ski jor. That's part of the beauty of the sport is you can do this sport with one or two. So it's a very manageable sport for a lot of people in that respect. But I do have 10. I've got a lot of boys and a few girls, just happens to be. And I've got...
The breeds?
They're Alaskan Husky, German Shorthair as well. I have one remaining Alaskan Husky left. He's very old and he's just enjoying his retirement. But I love the Alaskan Husky as well. But they're all awesome dogs. But Teddy and Winston are my two beasts. They're kind of heathens, but in a good way.
Well, when do you decide to go ski joring and when do you decide to go mushing? Because what are, you know, the differences and what appeals to you about each?
I started ski joring in approximately 1994 or so, and I ski jored for years and years, and I've had a variety of dogs throughout the years, and they've just all, you know, I've got to keep them until they pass on and get more. But a friend of mine introduced me to mushing in about 99, I think. And so, of course, I got addicted to that just as well. So with mushing, you need more dogs, clearly. And, of course, if you are going to race in the four dog, let's say, class, you kind of need that fifth spare in case you have a lame dog. You want to still be able to. So, you know, I kept coming up with the excuse of why I needed another dog and another dog, you know, and that you know, it just grew. But it's addicting because it's healthy, it's fun, and I like speed and I like power. So when I'm ski joring, I definitely like a two dog team. And they egg each other on too. So a two dog team tends to kind of be more driven. But you know, dogs are you know individuals too. So you can have a phenomenal single dog often as well.
I would think that when you graduated to mushing, you might not ski jore that much anymore because
that does happen a lot.
Yeah,
but I'm loyal to the ski jore club. That's where it all started for me. If you remember Danger Zone and Chariots of Fire and some of those old songs back in the day,
yeah.
I saw a video. I went down to Alaska Mill and Feed one time, and I saw this video of somebody ski joring, and the music was just powerful, and the dogs were just flying. I literally got chills. The dogs were flying down the trail, and I thought, oh, my God, I have to do this. I instantly got addicted to it.
Yeah.
So I started ski joring. And that's how, and it grew from there. Like I said, I got introduced to the mushing, but I'm loyal to the ski joring sport as well. So stick with it.
It's real easy to go from one dog to 20.
Yeah, you know? Man, be careful, folks.
Yeah, be
right,
careful.
Yeah.
Our one word of warning.
It's Outdoor Explorer, and we're talking today about dogs in this half of the show about ski joring, which is being pulled around by a dog on your cross country skis, and it's an amazingly fast sport. I mean, when you do it. The first time you do it, it can feel a little intimidating because just the speed and power of a dog pulling you on skis, but also lots of fun and quite the adrenaline rush. And we've got a very active ski joring community here in Anchorage with racing and lessons, and they'll teach you how to do it. Two of those club members are with me today on the show. Kim Wells, who does clinics and teaches newbies, and Chuck Pratt, who does a lot of race setup and helps run the ski joring races. Chuck, tell me about a ski joring race. What kind of distances do you do, and how do you address the aspect of everybody having kind of different dogs? I mean, is there any kind of handicapping, or is it just like you try to get the fastest dogs you can get and go for it?
Well, first off, with our club, the ski jor races are more like events. So I wouldn't deter anybody listening from thinking it's a race, and I'm not at that level. We encourage all levels, any dog, as long as it's, you know, controllable. So for that matter, it's more of just a fun event, and we're just out having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have a 10K race, and then with that said, a race, you know, and then a 5K. So two different distances, and then people can choose to do two dogs or one dog in each distance. And then after each timed event, we have the course open to touring. And that's another time for people that don't want to actually be pressed by the clock and just want to go get out on some trails that not normally accessible, like the Chugiak trails, Kincaid, Hillside, and Bartlett, places that we're generally not allowed to ski jour on. It's a great time to go and check out those new trails.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask that. Where can you normally ski during multi-use trails, like the coastal trail and stuff like
multi-use
that?
Multi-use, coastal trail, going around Chester Creek, Campbell Track. Archangel is...
At Hatcher Pass.
Oh, up at Hatcher Pass is prime. It's the first place to come in and the last place to go out.
Mm-hmm.
Power Line. And then Willow has a whole bunch of trails that are okay for, you know, the snow machining, and they kept groomed. So you can ski jour, you know, anywhere. The places that are definitely verboten are Kincaid and Hillside, designated ski area only.
Right, because the dog footprints and people footprints kind of mess up all that beautiful grooming.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like if you wanted to go backcountry, and you can cover a tremendous amount of ground with dogs.
Oh, yeah. Then it all depends upon your gear. You can get set up with the dogs and a sled, and then you sort of in between. And a gal named Laura Wright has been working on doing the whole Iditarod trail. She's done some pretty long ski jour trips. That's pretty, that's, you know, one of those dream kind of things, you know, big commitment. But you can also just go out and go cruising around. I've done a couple of 20, 30 mile days where we're not going as fast. I start the dogs off going slower just for the long distance and hanging out, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know people up in Fairbanks, a lot of people in Fairbanks will have the huskies from distance mushers. And so those dogs will just drop in a trot and they can go for a long ways.
And a better coat for that climate too.
Right. Yeah. So how many people are participating in these races? And just to get a sense of how big the ski jouring community is in Anchorage.
We have anywhere from 30 to 50 members. The last couple years has been sort of a big hit on our membership.
The bad winners, yeah.
In fact, we didn't hold one of our planned events last year. Did not go off, mm-hmm. not one. But typically we'll have anywhere from 15 to 25 people lining up to go on the races, on the tours. And then we also have like show and goes. And we had a show and go that was at Goose Lake not too long ago. It was well attended with almost 20 people showing up with dogs and everything. And that's just a real low-key event where people want to come out and hit a multi-use trail and be exposed to other dogs, to learn about passing, just to bring the dogs that are just learning the sport, to expose them to others. And it works really well to have bait. One dog will chase another dog like nobody's business. So
that's sort of like you see how it's done and then you learn.
Yeah, dogs learn well from another dog, actually.
So all those events that Chuck mentioned, you can probably find out about at AnchoredSkiJourClub.org, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's the website, and you'll find it on our website at OutdoorExplorer.org. Just click on today's show and we'll have all the information. So Kim, Chuck kind of touched on this idea of seeing other people do it and having your dogs sort of figure it out from watching. As someone who's never tried it, that seems to me like it would be pretty important first step, is having the dogs understand what you're doing and how to follow your commands. Is it kind of like mushing where the G and haw is right and left and whoa and everything else?
Yeah, whoa being, of course, the most important one, especially when you don't have brakes, because on the dog sled we have a brake. So you can stop them.
And skis are snow plowing, but it couldn't.
You're the brake.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, obviously, you know, people aren't going to just acquire a dog.
I guess number one, you have to be a good skier.
You don't have to be. It obviously helps a great deal.
Yeah, I would think so.
But, it's a big plus. I did it the hard way. I wasn't a good skier
really?
In the beginning. So I fell a lot. And, you know, just try not to get frustrated.
Get dragged along the ground.
Yeah, I've been dragged along the ground a few times. But, you know, if you can go out and practice your skiing a little bit on the nights that the dog is home resting, because, you know, you don't want to take him out every night and mm-hmm. wear him out. You want to leave him wanting more. You want to leave a positive imprint on the dog mm-hmm. at all times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you get out there and you practice your skiing. You can take a lesson or two here or there just to get the basics down. And then you get out there a couple times a week, you know, and practice with the dog and always positive with your commands, the G and Ha, the Woe, the On By. So, you know, we do use the same commands as the mushrooms.
So how do you train the same way as if you were training a dog to come? You just throw them a treat when they do it right?
No, you don't want to do the treat thing because that tends to make them want to stop. They'll look for the treat, and
okay.
especially if they're food motivated. So praise. You're happy. They feed off of our energy. So if you're happy and you're loving on your dog and you're telling them how good they are, that works a good part of the time.
Well, I'm keeping it short. Start off with just 15 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever. You're not going to go out and run a marathon today, mm-hmm. you know. You build up to it. So keeping it short, keeping it positive, that's the real key.
And you could always progress your distances, you know, as both of you get in better shape. And
For those of us who are sort of dog training challenged, how do you get the dog to figure out, like, the first time what G means?
Well,
you can use a buddy. You can mm-hmm. have someone out in front. If your dog doesn't want to be out in front, you can have them with a leash while you're connected to the harness, you know, out front. Mm-hmm. And then you can start by saying, you know, G, and you're already moving over there.
Yeah.
If you have a dog that naturally wants to be out in front, when you call a command, they're going to look back at you and say, what does he want me to do? So by that point, by the time I call G, I'm already moving in the right direction. Or if I say Ha, I'm already moving in the left direction, so that they can start realizing that that's what that means. So you lead by example. You're already moving in there.
I see.
And in that direction.
Well, it's like really brings up the value of the club and of getting involved with their clinics, because if you're trying to figure that out totally on your own and your dog's trying to figure it out totally on his or her own, then it's going to be much harder.
Yeah. And we, you know, dogs are amazingly smart. I don't think we always give them the credit
mm-hmm.
That they deserve. They can figure this stuff. If you're consistent and it's always positive, or the best you can be positive, you know, the most you can be positive with it, they get it. They figure it out. You're just consistent and you know, it's always you're demonstrating, you're teaching. And like Chuck says, you know, you just kind of lead them. Like I would get out on the trail and I would say, gee, come on, you know, Rocky and whatever the dog's name is, you know, and you're happy and you lead them that way. And then they start getting it. And then you get excited because they get it.
It sounds like a peaceful dog that is not going to try to fight or chase is probably important, right? I mean, there's some dogs that are a little bit neurotic.
You don't want one that's going to fight for sure,
mm-hmm.
you know. Some dogs, the neuroses can actually help.
Yeah.
You know?
Depends on what form of neurosis. Huh?
Right. My prime maxim when it comes to ski-touring is to know your dog. You need to know how your dog's going to react in any given situation. When I'm running my three dogs, I've got one dog that always runs on the left, one dog always runs on the right, and, you know,
Shadow's
in the middle.
Yeah.
They just have a habit.
They do.
But you need to know what's going to happen. You need to know when was the last time you passed a tree that had a squirrel in it. Because they're going to want to look for that squirrel next time you go by.
Right.
You're going to know, I go by through the dog park quite often, just as good pass training, mm-hmm. Just to tell them to go on by and just to build their confidence that everything's going to work out okay.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing your particular dog and is when a dog comes at you from the side of the trail, how is it going to react? That's really good. If you know the cues your dog's sending you, you can say, okay, he's getting tired, or he doesn't like this, or, you know, there's just a whole bunch of different things that can react.
It sounds like a really rewarding way to relate to your dog when it's easy to get into a relationship with the dog of like, well, you feed it, you water it, you know, it's just sort of dependent. But here you're a little bit more partners.
There's a lot of trust that you build. And, you know, it really is up to us to do it right. And
mm-hmm.
if you just have the right attitude and you're consistent and your dog learns that they can trust you, it's an amazing connection.
Yeah,
it really is.
So I know you guys had some points you wanted to make sure you got to today. And so I want to give you the opportunity to do that. We still have several minutes left, but I just don't want to leave you without getting all your points in.
Right. Well, being a ski jewer, being a responsible mm-hmm. member of the public, we always want to pick up our poop.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a...
Politeness.
That's a
politeness. For dog owners, it's yeah. like, right. yeah. If we could only just give everybody in Anchorage a brain transplant so we'd all get along.
Right.
The dog owners would be nice to the non-dog owners,
oh,
and the non-dog owners
would
cool
amazing.
It, right?
Anchorage yeah. would be the perfect city.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. You know, my main point is knowing your dog, mm-hmm. Picking up on the cues mm-hmm. for, you know, in the house. Everything is the total bond. It is a total team sport. So,
yeah.
And you can't just assume that you're going to get up off the couch in, say, November and you're already doing 10 miles.
Yeah.
You know, you have to build.
And like it. Everything good, it takes some work.
Yeah.
So were there other ski touring clubs around Anchorage or around the U.S.? I mean, are we kind of like the national center of ski touring, or is this something that is happening other places?
Well, we are definitely the Anchorage club. To mm-hmm. my knowledge, there's no other Anchorage
right.
club, but Fairbanks has a club.
Okay.
And there are ski touring clubs all around the United States and probably, in Europe.
Seems like it's gaining in popularity.
Oh, it's, I hope so. I uh-huh. really do, because it's just, I don't see any negatives to it. It's just positive in every way. But, we try to connect when we plan our schedules of events, that we don't overlap with other clubs so people can attend other things best.
Mm-hmm.
best
other mushing
yeah,
clubs.
Yeah, other mushing clubs as well.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. But, do you guys, have things you do with like, Fairbanks and have races with them?
We do travel. Some of us do travel. Mm-hmm. I mean, the more hardcore, more serious racers, like Chuck and I, we like to go to some of the races at Montana Creek and Fairbanks or Toke and Chugiak in some of these places where we can have some mushing ski touring events or just ski touring events as well. They are all, I mean, the sport's been around a long time
yeah.
and we do try to connect. And
And believe it or not, there's actually world championships of ski touring
yeah.
of dog sports. So
where is that, like over in Scandinavia?
Well, every 2 years, it's either on our continent or, I've been to two of them myself. I got to go to.
That must be fun.
Oh, it's exciting. I did one in Fairbanks in 2001. I did another one.
In 2013, it was in North Pole.
Yeah, in Dawson City. I did one in 2005 in Dawson City on the Yukon River.
Neat.
Whiskey during and mushing world uh-huh. championships. So.
Go ahead.
I'd like to just touch on mm-hmm. February 26th, coming right up here. Mm-hmm. We have the AMH Kincaid Classic, which is a 10K. Time trial relative dog thing, and then there's the 5K mass start, which is like a Le Mans kind of thing.
Oh wow!
Which is it is the only way races should be done, because it is such a kick in the pants.
I bet
you have no idea what's going to happen as everybody's starting. We start with our skis 50 yards down the trail, and then you run up with your dogs, try to hook into your skis. And then off you go. Yeah, off you go. And that is either just come and watch the mass start, but mm-hmm. come
and
participate.
Where does that take place?
At a Kincaid in the stadium.
Cool.
Right?
And the date again is
February 26th.
Okay,
so it's
fabulous.
Coming right up.
Yep.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I'm sure your other events are on the website that we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, thanks so much for being here, both of you. And do you want to mention any clinics you have coming up, Kim?
The clinics are done for the season.
Okay.
But I don't want to discourage anybody. If anybody even wants to get started late in the season at this point, to contact us. Sometimes some of us can do individual where
sure.
we just go out with somebody. And
or just come to one of these races and check it out.
Yeah, just because it's a race doesn't mean you shouldn't come.
Yeah.
Because we have something for everybody.
Fantastic.
Ski touring can also use other animals. There are horses, but I've never seen anybody actually do it with a cat.
I actually did.
Oh, there we have it.
It was a YouTube video. You should look it up.
Let's talk about herding cats, huh?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. Chuck Pratt and Kim Wells, they're both members of the Anchorage Ski Drawer Club. And it sounds like an awful lot of fun. Stick with us. In the second half, we're going to talk about wintertime dog care and taking your dogs outdoor and all your activities, how to keep them safe and make sure that their welfare is good. So stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Well, we're talking about dogs today, and in Alaska, we have a lot of talk about dogs with the mushers heading out in Fur Rondi and the Iditarod and, you know, the ski jorers we were just talking about. But for most of us, our dogs are not elite athletes. Our dogs are just kind of schlubby family members like we are. And so I thought it would be good to talk about how we handle our dogs in the wintertime for outdoors activities and also just at home. Dogs are, of course, outdoor animals. Not many of them want to be inside all the time. And in Alaska, we have some special issues. We have deep snow, we have cold, and there's actually a nonprofit in Anchorage that addresses these issues about dogs and keeping them safe and happy in the wintertime, and it's called Straw for Dogs, and one of its co-founders is Matisse Riley, who is with me today. She's also a certified professional dog trainer. Thanks for being here, Matisse.
Thank you for having me.
So I think maybe a good place to start here is why Straw for Dogs came into existence, because obviously you saw a need out there with dog care and dog welfare in Alaska in particular.
Absolutely. That, like we were discussing earlier, there's a lot of information out there if you are into dog sports such as mushing or ski joring on proper care for animals outdoors, but there's not a lot for pet dog owners. So you might have, you know, you might have lived next to somebody with a dog who shelter was a little shabby or lacking, or the dog appeared to be cold or have something that could be improved. So we developed Straw for Dogs as a way to reach families and give them information on how they can improve, make improvements on their own.
Right. And not all dogs are bred for the Arctic, obviously. I mean, some of them are bred specifically to be outdoor in the wintertime, but most are not.
Absolutely. And a lot of the dogs, even that we think of being heavy coated, might not have that double coat. So just because the dog's a husky, which is a kind of a general term, doesn't mean that they have a thick double coat and that they're acclimated to living outdoors.
Huh. So what are some of the biggest issues that you see that people need to know about or think more about in terms of family dog care in the wintertime?
Well, if you have a dog who lives outside or spends primarily most of their time outside, you can provide a much better shelter for them by using, say, a insulated, heavy-duty wooden doghouse, checking it to make sure there's no leaks, making sure the dog has access, whether that means being free run in a yard, in a pen, or on a tie-out that isn't getting tangled. That's when you might consider using a swivel or something like that. So access to a quality shelter is number one for sure.
Right.
And then of course, supplying water. You either need to think about using a heated water bowl, or a great mushing trick is baiting the food with water so that the animal is getting the water while they eat the food. And so they're getting hydration twice a day with meals.
Hmm. So that means essentially just pouring water in with the food so they get both at the same time?
Yeah, you might make a gruel with some broth so that it's even better, so that the dog will eat it before it freezes.
Right. So I know a lot of mushers feed the dogs warm food. And that seems like it makes sense. Why give an outdoor athlete something cold when they're outdoors all the time?
Sure. And if you can do that, that's great. Even just some warm water.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So one of the issues for our Alaskan dogs is that as much as we brag about our outdoor lifestyle, most of us are indoors, obviously the vast majority of the time, especially in the wintertime, and so are our dogs, and we all can get a little bit stir crazy. And I suppose there maybe are some little teacup dogs that don't need much exercise, but most dogs, I mean, exercise is part of their health. They need to be outside, right?
Sure, it depends on the dog. Some dogs are definitely more into getting out and getting some serious panting exercise. Some dogs are more comfortable laying around the house.
Uh-huh.
And
like old dogs.
Yeah, old dogs, or even just certain breeds, or even certain dogs within that breed.
So it's when you pick your dog, pick the dog that fits your lifestyle, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And be honest with yourself. Do you really want to hike every day for an hour?
Right. So when the weather is really cold or the snow is very deep, then these can be issues for folks. And so let's talk first about the deep snow, which could be an issue like in your backyard, or it could be an issue out on the trail if you want to take your dog, you know, on a skiing or snowshoeing expedition or something. Are there risks for dogs in the deep snow?
It's definitely worth considering because your dog, you know, it definitely is more taxing for your dog. So again, considering your dog's actual fitness level, if you go out once or twice a year to go skiing, your dog probably isn't up for a half day ski through deep snow. And you might be prone to injuries, or he might be prone to injuries. So definitely think about that. In your backyard, you could shovel, make some tunnels, shovel out a nice area to encourage your dog to use the restroom outside. But definitely considering that the deep snow changes the landscape for the dog. Even towards a doghouse, you need to shovel the snow away from the door. So the deep snow can affect the way we care for dogs outside.
Right. So there could be issues like with joints and stuff when they're trying to bound through deep snow. Is that one of the things?
Well, it could be that they could injure their legs, right? Mm-hmm. Or a paw or something like that through the deep snow. You can't see what's under the snow. That could be an issue if mm-hmm. we're talking about, other types of injuries like sticks or falling on rocks or injuring a paw somehow like that. So, but I think the taxing part is what I see in the deep snow.
I see.
It's very
like
taxing for
just
the
like us when we become couch potatoes. If a dog is suddenly over-exercising, that could be a threat.
Yeah, absolutely working up to it, just like a professional dog sport person would do.
Interesting. What about the paws? And I know mushers a lot of times will use booties, things to protect the paws, and when it's snowy out, some dogs can get a lot of snow impacted between their toes, right?
Yes, and that can be really painful for the dog. So considering, maybe grooming there, using booties, they even have some full coats that I've seen that can help with dogs who get the snowballs all the way up the arms.
Oh, wow.
Because maybe they've got the longer spaniel hair or something like that you don't really necessarily want to cut short. But so a full coverage snowsuit might help with that as well. But booties for sure.
I'm picturing the Anchorage kindergartner going out with the snowsuit and the mittens on the strings, right? And making this into a dog. That sounds, everybody wants to dress their dog anyway, right?
So. And they have some great options now and some locally you can
okay.
purchase. Yeah, absolutely. But the booties, you can, all different types. I like the rubbery ones. That's a certain brand.
Okay, you can say it.
Okay, I wasn't sure. It's called Paws, and they sell them at Mill and Feed. They come in a plastic container of maybe 12 of them.
So you get quite a few. You're going to lose some, right?
Yeah, so I kind of like that. But then I would maybe even layer a musher booty on top, which they also sell locally mm-hmm. available everywhere.
And those will have a little string on them to tie them on, or how do they stay on?
The plastic ones just are kind of, they fit over. So if they're fitted correctly, that's important mm-hmm. so that they're not too tight. But they just kind of go on like a balloon almost. And I've had good luck with those staying on, easy to get on and off. I would throw a few in my backpack even in the summer when we're out hiking so that we have those if we need them for a paw injury.
Okay, interesting. So in terms of cold and how to sort of deal with cold weather with a dog, I'm seeing more and more people whose dogs are wearing like sweaters and coats and stuff like that. And I always wonder if that's like really necessary, if it's just something that people enjoy doing, or, what's your take on that?
That's a good question. I think both. So it would depend on the dog again, mm-hmm. You'll know if your dog enjoys wearing his sweater. And if he is a dog who runs cold, he like being outside less. Shivering, those kinds of mm-hmm. obvious signs of being cold. So I actually thought it was kind of a joke until I had a dog of my own who liked to wear a coat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And then, do you use it every time? Or how do you choose when to dress up your dog? Because, frankly, if you've got a dog and you're a busy person, like, you know, at least with me, everything the vet recommends, I feel like I could spend my entire day just dealing with the dog, right?
True. Absolutely. That's the ideal, right? Do what you can. So it depends on the dog. And I know what with our dog, it was about 10 degrees. Mm-hmm. So if we were going to go for a walk, sometime extended outside, we would put the coat on and the booties and everything at about 10 degrees or colder. Maybe you have a dog who really is not having a good time going out to the yard even to use the bathroom. Mm-hmm. Maybe you coat the dog just to go outside then for short breaks.
So it's kind of like if you're switching from your fleece coat to your big parka, then like switch your dog from just fur to something to warm him up.
And some dogs will never take to a coat, and they don't need a coat. And even if they don't have a full, thick Siberian Husky coat, they might just not run cold like that, and they're fine without a coat.
Uh-huh. So cold weather issues, we talked about sort of having some kind of clothing for the dog, and I suppose that there comes a point where we don't really do anything outdoors and probably dogs should just be kept indoors. I mean, when it gets down well below zero. True?
I think that dogs enjoy being indoors. And so, mm-hmm. again, it depends on the dog. You know, if your dog is dying to go outside 5 minutes after he comes inside, providing him with that space to do so.
So what I observe is like, yeah, the dog wants to go outside. She's sick of being inside, but she only wants to stay outside for about 12 seconds when she goes, oh my God, it's cold. And, at least my dog does not have like a huge mental capacity. So it's not like she remembers that she doesn't want to go outside.
She still wants to go outside.
Comes yeah. back in and thinks, oh, I hate being inside. I think I'll go outside again. So you could just stand there at the door and open and close it.
That's where a dog door might be handy.
Yeah, right. what do you do with your, do you do any outdoor stuff with dogs in the winter in terms of like your family outdoor stuff that you like to do?
We love to go hiking in the winter, of course, less bear activity. Mm-hmm. So we love to take them out. The Gasline Trail is off, says off-leash area for dogs, which is okay. nice to go for a ski.
So that's up towards Hillside Park. By Hillcrest Ski area? Is that true?
It does connect there. Okay. Yeah, so it actually connects through North Bouviac. That's the off-leash area that connects okay. there, and then it's kind of Muldoon, Tudor area. So it's a nice, decent run that you could take the dogs out on and go skiing, and it's pretty flat. There's a few hills, but nothing major.
Yeah, I mean, it's important for people to know that our groomed ski trails in Anchorage, you're not supposed to have dogs on because
exactly.
it messes them up.
Yes, yes.
And a lot of people seem not to know that.
Or having an off-leash dog in a leashed area.
Yeah.
Yes.
What are some other areas where you can, I guess in the state parks and stuff like that, you can have your dog off-leash?
Yeah, once you get away from the trailhead or mm-hmm. the dog is under control of the trailhead. Also, you could take a ski around Connor's Bog, which is an off-leash area. That's a nice little area to go for a ski. There's some nice trails through the woods and all.
Mm-hmm. And I think University Lake maybe has some trails.
Sure. There's areas there that I'm unaware of which is the dog park and which is the other trail.
It's so, a little vague, yeah.
Yeah, I don't actually go there much, but I know a lot of people enjoy it there.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about dogs today, obviously, and my guest is Matisse Riley. She is the co-founder of Straw for Dogs, which is a pretty active organization that is dedicated to taking care of dogs outdoors and making sure that they have good welfare, and making sure that folks know how to do that. And we're just talking about, since we talked about ski joring and sort of athletic dogs in the first half, now we're sort of talking about for the rest of us. And my name is Charles Wolforth. So let's talk about a little bit about behavioral issues, which span summer and winter, but we were talking about going to dog parks and going to, you know, these off-leash areas. And not everybody knows how to train their dog or has gotten their dog to the point where maybe they're appropriate for off-leash. And I'm just wondering, would you agree with that assessment? What does that look like to you?
So good question. And I think it has a lot to do, again, with the dogs being individuals. So not all dogs enjoy the crazy play that's the dog park. And of course, some dog parks are different. There's more room at Connor's Bog. You can continue to walk away from, you know, if maybe some dogs are getting too boisterous or whatnot. Some parks like the Finston Park on Arctic, it's a lot closer space. Mm-hmm. So knowing your dog and honoring what your dog is telling you. If they're uncomfortable at the dog park and they're snapping at other dogs, they want their ball only and they're, you know, being very protective of that, that isn't a dog who necessarily is enjoying themselves at the dog park. Uh-huh. And in fact, could be impacting other people's experience and other dogs.
Right. So part of this is on the owner, right?
Absolutely. Because we're the ones who drive them there and mm-hmm. cut them loose.
But in terms of like the dog behavior is not... I mean, it's not just the dog. It's sort of like, has the dog really been given the opportunity to learn, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And even if you've done all this socialization, I have many clients who've done all the proper puppy socialization and their dog grew out of the dog park. So that happens too. So just knowing that your dog might decide he doesn't like the wild party, frat party at the dog park anymore. And maybe he enjoys a dinner party with friends instead. as in a smaller play group at a friend's home or something like that.
Is that a just part of like normal maturing, like human beings do? Like as you grow, you become more sedate and have less interest in being wacky?
It appears to be that way because a lot of younger dogs enjoy the dog park, and whether they're really doing well or not might be up for interpretation at the dog park. Are they really bullying other dogs, or are they being just boisterous and silly? Kind of those fine lines. Mm-hmm. But it does seem that a lot of dogs grow out of it, and maybe it has to do even with aches and pains as they get older. Mm. Or maybe it just is a difference in
energy level.
Yeah, or in social preferences.
So if you're, I mean, I don't know if you use the, how much you use the dog park, but do you see folks who really have dogs that are not properly controlled or not behaving correctly with the other dogs who should like maybe not be there?
I think we see that all over Anchorage. Mm-hmm. And we hear a lot of folks complaining about, you know, on the trails, the dogs approaching them and, you know, harassing their dog who's on a leash and all this. So being courteous and being aware, you know, just because your dog, just because you want to take your dog out at 2 o'clock or, you know, 2 o'clock on an afternoon on Saturday on the coastal trail doesn't mean that's an appropriate situation for your dog. Or same thing at the dog park. Mm-hmm. So if your dog is showing you that they're uncomfortable, they're aggressing towards other dogs or people, address those issues and come up with other solutions, which there's plenty to get your dog exercise.
Right. Well, the if you see somebody who's freaked out by your dog yelling, it's okay, he's friendly, is probably not a good enough
that's
answer.
That's
the right?
worst. Yes, that's the worst.
Especially if it's a kid or something who's freaking out. Yeah, I think that we, you know, it's so much of these issues that dog owners and non-dog lovers have could be sort of resolved just by relaxing a little bit, right?
Yeah, we all could relax a little bit around it for sure.
And being just sort of conscious that just because you love your dog doesn't mean somebody else does.
Yes, and thinking about the many reasons why they might not want your dog to jump on them or run up to mm-hmm. them or whatnot, and that's okay.
Yeah, so voice control means in the leash law says voice control. What does that mean exactly?
Well, that's up for interpretation, unfortunately, mm-hmm. as well, right?
Well, let's not get into the legalities, but right. for you as a professional, what does it mean?
It would mean your dog, you could call them and they would be right next to you. So when I see people like that walking down the coastal trail with their dog off leash, that is not an issue for me. That dog is right with them. They're not approaching other mm-hmm. leash dogs or chasing people on bikes or even getting in the way of people on bikes or something mm-hmm. like that.
Can be dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And voice control, I would think, means like, you know, almost all the time. It doesn't mean like if you call the dog five times and it comes, then that's not it, right?
Unfortunately, no.
Yeah, which I think is a lot. That's how a lot of people interpret it.
Yeah.
So how do you, as a dog trainer, how do you develop that level of compliance to get where you really are in control?
Well, it is a process. Mm-hmm. Your recall is kind of a college level for a real recall or mm-hmm. a real voice control heel. We're talking college level training and working with a long line, working with the dog well before you let him off leash, especially in a especially distracting situation, say like on the coastal trail. You might have better luck in the deep snow where there's only one trail.
Right.
And so, you know, practicing your recalls, maybe practicing it with a long line. There's a great video I like online called Bacon Recall, because most people have done the mistake of calling many times, maybe even punishing their dog when they finally do come back because they're so frustrated. So their recall is kind of, it's never going to get there now.
Uh-huh.
So instead, just training a whole new recall and something that you train as you only say it when you're ready to reward and in situations you know the dog can be successful. And so it's called Bacon Recall. Definitely look it up. And I retrained my dogs with a whistle using that same technique because I'd done the same thing as everyone else mm-hmm. has done of using my recall when I wasn't able to make sure the dog could listen.
Mm. So in other words, create the opportunity for success, just like teaching kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You can manage the environment while teaching and then you'll get a good effect.
I hate always admitting embarrassing things on the show, but I've found that in training my dog to come, I always use this bag of treats. And the dog has essentially trained me that unless I have the bag of treats and she can hear it shaking, she's not going to come. And it's not like she's ill-willed. It's just she thinks, I've got steps that lead up to my back door.
Yes.
She'll come to the bottom of the steps, and I could call her all day. And until she hears that thing shaking, she's not going to come, right?
Right. You've trained it that way.
Right.
With now, the bag of treats first.
And now I can't get it to the next step.
So you could go back and change it, mm-hmm. use a different cue, like the whistle or something, and then the reward comes after the behavior. So that's the real secret. The reward isn't used as a bribe beforehand.
It's
used as a surprise after.
But now I'm not going to be able to change what she does when she hears my voice. It's going to be about having a new cue that she's learning.
Right, like that bacon recall video, which is how I return mm-hmm. the whistle. So just using, it could be any word. You can choose anything. The words don't matter. Or a signal like the whistle.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that some, and I suppose this is a breed thing, that some breeds seem to be much better than this than others. Some are maybe more curious. There's a very funny YouTube video of, I think it's a golden retriever that's trying to do a dog show thing where
the agility
has to go between there's distractions on each side and it has to make it from one side to the other.
I've seen that.
Yeah, and like it destroys every single thing, right?
Yeah, definitely some breeds are maybe have been bred for different types of work.
Uh-huh.
But again, there's individuals in each breed class, so it has to do with the training as well.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you want to get into something like mushing or ski joring and turn your dog into a real athlete, then that's a whole additional level of training, and also really important to choose the right kind of dog for that kind of thing. Yes?
I think so, and really considering your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Do you have time for that second job?
Right.
You know, there's such great information available through all the mushing associations here.
Mm-hmm.
You could talk to somebody and really get your toe dipped in before you bought a dog or adopted a dog with the intent to have dogs for those purposes.
You need to go out and try mushing multiple times, maybe go on a trip or you know, work in a dog yard for a while, because it's... As I've either recreational mushers, you don't have to be a racer, but just being a recreational musher is complete lifestyle.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a lot of time that you're mm-hmm. committing. So you might not have that time. And that's maybe you could do something else. Like you could do ski joring with your one pet dog, or you could do bike joring. You could volunteer or with Iditarod, or get your dog fixed some other way.
Yeah. So, short of that, a lot of people use their dogs on backcountry trips, even multi-day trips, and will get the dog to carry stuff. And you see that kind of equipment, like you mentioned, mill and feed and that sort of thing. Any tips on like getting your dog to carry stuff, and how much is a good idea, and sort of how to do one of those multi-day things?
You might work up to it. Mm-hmm. When we've gone on multi-day trips, we've carried or skied with the pulk, and the dog just kind of skied in front of us.
Uh-huh.
So there was some help there, but they weren't carrying the large load.
Mm-hmm.
We have done backpacks, that kind of thing, and definitely working up to it, even weight, making sure the backpack's well-fitted. Those are all really important.
Don't throw it on for the first time when you're taking off for this multi-day trip.
Right. No, work up to it for sure. And work up to even the idea of wearing the backpack.
Mm-hmm.
So that itself might be a lot for the dog to get used to.
Because the dog could, I would think, would just have difficulty with it probably psychologically, but also be a real issue to figure out how much the dog can carry, because he's not necessarily built for that.
Yeah, you'd want to, you know your dog. Does he already have some issues with his legs, or, you know, some hip issues or something?
Mm-hmm.
And how old is your dog? Have they done these kinds of exercises before? And a vet could give you a better number of how many pounds per pounds of dog, you know, an average would be suggested.
Right. So if you're on skis or snowshoes, and the dog obviously isn't on skis or snowshoes, although my kids talk about that constantly, about like, well, wouldn't it be cool if Posey was on skis? They're going to be expending a lot more effort than you are.
Exactly. And we're coming back to the deep snow, right, and how that can be really hard on the dog. So maybe going where the trails broke a little wider
mm-hmm.
and kind of planning your trip that way if you have a dog you're bringing along.
So any other thoughts on multi-day trips? It sounds like you've done that.
We've done a few cabin camping mm-hmm. trips. Yeah, so it's fun. We love going out with the dogs and doing something like that. Again, less bears in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Some things, of course, you need to think about are snares or traps on the trails.
Yeah.
So that's another reason that your dog should be under voice control or leashed.
And not running off to the side.
Yeah.
And potentially getting lost or getting into a trap. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And definitely educating yourself about that if you want to go out into some of these more remote areas or closer in areas too.
Yeah. It seems like you probably are carrying a lot of dog food, and I mean, it's going to add a significant amount to what you're taking.
Yes, and we carry some bedding,
okay,
and a first aid kit for the dogs, which we've got the paws, booties, vet wrap type, you know, stuff, some cleaner, that kind of thing, disinfectant.
In case of like foot problems, a piece of ice or something.
Yeah, cut a paw. That's an easy one, you know. And if you're that far out, you might need to just address that before you expect them to walk back out. And just having a few things on hand, their medications if they have medications.
Right.
If they maybe are prone to allergies, bringing that just if they could have, you know, whatever they might need.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
I think it is.
It adds a whole new element, right?
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Yeah.
And there, you know, a lot of the public service cabins you can bring a dog to.
Yeah.
So it's a really fun way to get out with your dogs, which we can't always do.
Tell us about how people can support Straw for Dogs or how they can get help from Straw for Dogs if somebody has concerns about dog care.
Thank you. So Straw for Dogs, we have a new website. Strawfordogs.org.
Okay, and we'll make sure that's on outdoorexplorer.org if folks want to check out today's show.
Great, thank you. And through there, we have an application for assistance. There's a few different spots you can find it on the website. Anyone can fill it out, whether it's for your own animals or if you're a concerned neighbor and you want to remain anonymous. It's an easy online form. You don't have to print it and fax it or anything. And then we also have a volunteer application on there. And we're always looking for volunteers who are willing to commit to either just a one-time event or to longer-term help with the organization. And definitely send us an email if you have any questions as well at info@strawfordogs.org.
And if there's a dog that somebody's concerned about, it's not like they're turning them into the cops. It's more like you're going to come and sort of provide help and support so that person can take better care of their dog.
Yes, we offer our help. We offer supplies and resources for Pets Outdoors. And so that includes everything from a doghouse and straw. We have a pet food pantry. We have a lot of resources for other organizations throughout the state. So if somebody needs help, we can often refer them to wherever would be closer to them. And we again, are volunteers, so we're offering our support.
Mm-hmm.
We do work with animal control in Anchorage and Matsu Valley and recommend folks, if it's an emergency or if the law is being broken, to absolutely call the local enforcement.
Right. Great. Well, thanks for doing this. It's really nice to know that you're out there providing the support. And
Thank you. Many people
would not even know about it or think of it, and you're doing it. So my guest has been Matisse Riley. She's co-founder of Straw for Dogs. As we said, you can find that link on outdoorexplorer.org. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And that's all for today's show. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer, who lines up our guests for us, is Hannah Durrell. My name's Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.